From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Antarctica's ice sheets are melting three times as fast as they were a decade ago. That's according to a new study published in the journal Nature that shows that at this rate, Antarctica's melting ice will cause sea levels to rise 6 inches or 15 centimeters by the year 2100. Joining us now by Skype is Andrew Shepherd, who is a professor of Earth observation at the University of Leeds and a lead author on this study. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for calling.
And first of all, just explain how you carried out this study. You used satellite measurements of the ice.
Yeah, that's right. We've had polar explorers in Antarctica for a century or so, but the vast majority of the information we've learned about the continent has come from satellite measurements over the past two or three decades since the early 1990s.
So what did you find in this study?
So we used several different satellite techniques to try and count up how much ice is being lost. And what we found was that in West Antarctica in particular, the ice sheet was losing ice at what is now evidently an accelerating rate. So in the early 1990s and 2000s, Antarctica was still making a contribution to sea level rise, but quite a modest one and at a steady pace. And since about 2010, it's clear that the rate of ice loss is increasing year on year and that it's tripled, actually, in fact, in a very short time period.
And do we know why?
We do. Because the ice loss is occurring in West Antarctica, we know very clearly that that ice sheet is surrounded by the ocean. It sits on the seabed, in fact, and that's unique for Earth's ice sheets. All the rest of them rest on land that's above sea level. Hmm. And it places it in a particularly susceptible situation because small changes in ocean temperature can melt away a lot of ice. And that's what's happening. The ocean in front of West Antarctica is actually not that warm. It's only half a degree centigrade warmer than it should be. But the ice sheet there just can't withstand that amount of heat and it's melting away.
Were you surprised to discover this?
Sure, we were all surprised. This is a big study. It's like an international assessment, 80 or more authors. And I think our job is to count how much ice the polar ice sheets are losing, and we go about that day to day. But we only look at the measurements every so often when we are making these large-scale assessments. And it caught everybody by surprise who was involved in the project. We didn't expect to see the rate of ice loss triple in such a short time period.
When our listeners hear this, you know, it's not terribly surprising that the ice is melting in Antarctica. We've done stories about that before, but it's far away. Is there anything that anyone can do about it? Can we slow this melting down?
So I think what's important about the signal that we see is that it tells us really clearly that although, as you say, Antarctica's far away, it is now feeling the effects of climate change. And when we look at Antarctica from space, there's been a lot in the press about the fact that its sea ice hasn't been retreating, and so Antarctica might be insulated from climate change. Well, that's not the case. The heat is coming on the seabed, about a kilometre below sea level, and that's why the sea ice stays intact, because it's really far away from it, but the glaciers are melting. So we definitely now know that Antarctica is experiencing the effects of climate change. The question is whether we can do anything about it. Is not so easy. The ice will grow back if we cool the planet, but in all of the scenarios that we're putting forward to policymakers, none of those allow for a cooling of the planet. They allow for us to stop heating it up if we make drastic changes to our emissions. And so the reality is, I think that people should just be planning to adapt to this additional sea level rise rather than to try and stop it happening.
And what kind of sea level rise are you expecting at this point? We said 6 inches by the year 2100, which sounds also far away. And 6 inches doesn't sound like that much. But when you're talking about, you know, the oceans of the world, it probably is.
The issue is what additional sea level rise the Antarctica might contribute. And at the time of the last IPCC assessment report, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we provided an estimate of how much ice it was losing. And it was losing this steady rate and modest rate. And the expectation then was that Antarctica wouldn't make much of a contribution by 2100 at all. So now we see that it's following a different trajectory, the upper range of the scenarios, and that allows for a 15 centimeter sea level rise. Well, does that matter? it'll affect the vast majority of people in coastal areas in populated countries. It floods each year in coastal cities that are not protected by flood barriers, and there are only a few of those on the planet. It floods when high tides coincide with storm events. You've seen that in the States with Hurricane right. Sandy. And maybe that only happens once every year, once every 3 years, once every 5 years. But if you raise sea level by even such a small amount as 10, 20 or 30 centimeters, the frequency of those floods does go up quite considerably. You might be looking at 20 times per year. And that moves from an annoyance to a real impact on and disruption on people's daily lives. And so although you and I and most of your listeners won't think 15 centimeters additional sea level rise is anything to worry about, I can assure you that the urban planners that are thinking about flood defenses will take it seriously.
That's Andrew Shepherd, who's a professor of earth observation at the University of Leeds, and we'll link you to his study at hereandnow.org. Andrew, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Well, now to Colorado, where primary elections take place June 26th, and one congressional Democrat there is facing her most serious primary challenge in years. U.S. Rep. Diana DeGette is up against Syra Rao, a woman who, just a short time ago, wanted to break with the party. And as Sam Brash of Colorado Public Radio reports, it's forcing Denver Democrats to grapple with the future of their party.
For decades, Syra Rao enjoyed a happy relationship with the Democratic Party.
Bill Clinton was the first person I ever voted for in 1996. I named my ficus plant Hillary. Knocked doors, fundraising, all that kind of stuff.
Rao is Indian American and worked as a Wall Street lawyer before starting a company that promotes kids' books by diverse authors. Then came 2016. Rao supported Hillary Clinton and even canvassed for Diana DeGette. But after the election of President Trump,
it became clear to me that the corporate part of the Democratic Party, sort of the establishment, wasn't interested in my issues specifically, so issues of racial justice.
Rao feels the party hasn't done enough to protect undocumented immigrants or end mass incarceration. So in December of last year, she published an essay in the Huffington Post
called "I'm a Brown Woman Who's Breaking Up with the Democratic Party," talking about being a woman of color, feeling tokenized, feeling used.
The op-ed went viral. Some Democrats attacked Rao's perspective, but others wanted to know if Rao felt that way. Was she going to leave the party or do something about it?
So I hopped into the race in the middle of January.
Syra, speech, speech.
Oh, yeah, okay, hey.
In a backyard in southwest Denver, Rao launches a group of canvassers to knock doors and pass out campaign literature.
We are completely on target to win this thing. We've already knocked over 27,000 doors.
Despite that optimism, it won't be easy for Rao to unseat DeGette. The incumbent demolished her last primary challenger in 2016, winning 87% of the vote. But Rao has mounted a much more ambitious campaign. She outfundraised DeGette in the first quarter of this year, all while refusing to take any corporate PAC money. That stance is partially what attracted Xochitl Gaitan to Rao's campaign. But even more, Gaitan says that as a Mexican-American woman, identity matters as much as policy.
The simple fact that she is a woman of color and gets it and understands what it's like to live on the margins of society, to me, that made a huge difference.
And when it does come to policy, Rao says she wants to defund Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and eliminate all student debt.
And we're talking about people who are, again, working 2-3 jobs. They're sitting on a pile of student loan debt. They can't afford the rent. There is real distress here. And there's a real sense that nobody is listening.
To make sure residents are heard, Rao has pledged to hold a town hall in the district every month. She says DeGette hasn't done that enough.
I am offended by that allegation.
This, of course, is Representative Diana DeGette.
I come home every weekend. My husband and my dog and my kid live here. And I have an average of one town hall meeting a month.
That includes in-person town halls and telephone and Facebook town halls. At an ice cream social at a supporter's home in an upscale Denver neighborhood, DeGette reminds the audience of her track record in Congress. As co-chair of the pro-choice caucus, DeGette has fought for the repeal of the Hyde Amendment, which bars the use of federal funds for abortion.
Because what it says is wealthy women can use their insurance or their own money to get abortions. But poor women who are on Medicaid, they can't get one. And it really hits poor women and women of color.
And DeGette says that, unlike Rao, she has the seniority to be effective on everything from women's issues to campaign finance reform, especially if Democrats retake the House in November.
The question is, do people want to elect somebody who will be one of the most junior members of Congress, or do they want to elect somebody who actually knows how to introduce a bill and pass a bill through Congress?
As for Rao's argument that Democrats have neglected women of color, DeGette says,
I think that the Democratic Party and our whole society really needs to address the issue of race in a thorough and unvarnished way.
Representative DeGette says her experience means she's well prepared for that discussion. Saira Rao, on the other hand, is hoping the district's voters are ready for a fresh perspective. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash in Denver.
The Netflix reboot of the makeover show Queer Eye starts its second season tomorrow. It was born on Bravo in 2003 as Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, making a stereotype about gay men into a badge of honor, casting the Fab Five, five gay men, to give their pitiful straight counterparts more fashionable lives. The Netflix reboot is also a hit. It stars culture expert Karamo Brown, interior designer Bobby Burke, chef Anthony Porowski, grooming wizard Jonathan Van Ness, and fashion guru Tan France, who joins us now. Now, he's the immigrant son of Pakistani parents. He grew up in Britain, a Muslim. He settled in Salt Lake City, Utah, with his Mormon husband, Rob. And Tan joins us now from KUER in Salt Lake. Tan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You had an incredible first season of Queer Eye. Were you nervous at all? You stepped into the shoes of Carson Kressley, who, of course, you know, was on the first version of the program, a big star. Nervous?
I was. But I think we're very, very different people and our mission is very different. We're trying to find the best versions of the heroes that we help. That's what we call the people that we help, heroes. I don't just want them to look externally fantastic. I want them to be the best version of themselves that they can be.
Well, it comes at a time of incredible divisiveness. Many in the gay community are worried that some of their hard-fought gains might be lost. And so in a way, in this show, you're also ambassadors.
Yes, I believe we are. And we never set out for this to be a political show, for us to be a political statement. But just by nature of who we are five very diverse gay men, and our opinions are very strong. And we don't hesitate voicing those opinions. I think that it has become quite a political show.
Well, it's also, on occasion, the first encounter.
Yes.
You've met people who have never met a gay person before.
Yeah. In our first episode of season one, Tom Jackson, he had never met gay men as far as he was aware. He'd never spoken to a gay person before.
You like a lot of plaid, and I love plaid, but there's different ways of doing it.
I didn't buy most of these.
Who buys your product?
My ex-wife bought most of these.
Okay.
My second ex-wife.
Tom's closet is surprising. He likes color, which is bizarre from a man who doesn't seem to care about his appearance. So you know he's got a playful side. The closet actually gives me hope. He doesn't need to be a boring 57-year-old man.
And was this also the same gentleman who had never met a Muslim?
Yeah, this wasn't actually featured on the show. This was something that he had said during a filmed scene, but it never made it to air. He asked if I was a terrorist. He thought I was Mexican up until the second day. And then, I corrected him and said, no, I'm actually not Mexican, I'm Middle Eastern. And his first question, and he wasn't joking, it wasn't meant to be funny. He just asked if I was a terrorist. And the sad thing was that he didn't know that it was inappropriate to ask. And I feel no resentment towards him. And I felt none at the time, because I knew it was an honest question for him.
And later what? He gave you a rose?
He did. On the last day, a yellow rose for friendship. And he was really emotional when he gave it. He said, I don't want to do this on camera. I want this to just be a personal thing for us. I want you to know that I'd never met a person like you before, but you've become a true friend for me, and I hope you know that. So that felt really special, really special.
So this is about much more than what kind of hair gel.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so with my vertical being fashion, I use that as a vehicle for a much deeper conversation. I'm in a really privileged position on the show. I get to see these guys in their most vulnerable state. I get to see them in their underwear. And when I'm in that position where I get to see them undressed and I'm asking of them about how they feel about their bodies, it then opens up further conversation about how they view themselves in general, how their families view them. I'm able to talk about so much more than just, hey, let me make you pretty. Yeah.
I do just want to ask, though, you talk about how you're five diverse guys. Yes. And, you know, there's been criticism that it actually isn't in some ways a diverse group of gay men. I mean, there was upset for the first show and there is a little bit for the second.
Yes.
That it is playing into the stereotype that, you know, homosexual men are more fashionable. Tom Shales in the Washington Post said stereotypes on parade. Do you worry about that? Maybe you could have put an auto mechanic. could have worked on the cars or something.
We cannot represent every person within our community. However, we have me on the show. I'm Middle Eastern. I'm an immigrant. I'm of a certain religion. That's never been featured on a gay show before. Yeah. We have a black man on the show, Karama, who has children. We talk very openly about our marriages. I'm married to a man from Utah. So I think that this show and what we represent is more diverse than any other gay show that has been. Could it be more diverse? Of course, it always can be. But we can't represent everyone within our community. But we do try and do that with the people that we help. It is no longer called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. It's now just called Queer Eye. And we do have a gay hero on our show, episode 4. His name is AJ. And we show, and we don't hide away from this fact, that not all gay men know about the physical stuff, grooming, fashion, interior design. He struggles with all of that, and we help him.
Look, you mentioned the diversity in the heroes that you help, including one of the highlights of season 2. For the first time, a makeover for a transgender person. We meet Skylar in Athens, Georgia, born a woman, had top surgery. Identifies as a man, and a huge struggle to come to that place, left his family, is kind of living with a new family of young people that he's formed in a really frat-looking apartment.
Yes.
Really problematic. Wearing, you know, as I think you said, skateboarder. It's like a skateboarder at the age 30. To talk a little bit about what those unique issues are that Skylar told you about and you didn't know about.
A stereotype is that all gay men know everything there is to know about the LGBTQ community. We don't, and I air that on the show. Mm-hmm. I talk about the fact that we're lumped into the same group, but I know very little about the trans community.
Well, in fact, you wondered, why would you ever want to change your body? It's so painful. It costs so much money. And you have an incredibly powerful moment with Skylar.
So, like, God, I spent almost like a decade of my life being miserable in my body, just miserable. And the way that it affected me and the way that I interacted with people, like, I haven't even felt, like, comfortable giving hugs in, like, a decade because I, like, feel people touch my chest and it just makes me so uncomfortable.
I feel f***ing stupid, quite honestly.
You're not. No, I appreciate you trying to educate yourself. It means a lot to me.
No, I feel stupid. I always looked at trans people and thought, oh, why don't you just, like, it costs so much and it can be really painful. Why are you putting yourself through that? Like, it just seems such a traumatic experience.
It's a lot.
I truly didn't understand.
This was eye-opening to you.
Yeah, I knew that the trans community was going through a world of despair and not having the representation they deserved. But I never thought to ask the questions. And again, it's because I didn't feel that it was appropriate. But now I look back and I think I really should have taken the time to understand their plight more.
In another scene in season 2, you work with a woman named Tammy in gay Georgia.
Yeah.
and this episode, you're helping her welcome her son back to her church's homecoming. He's been away. He is gay. He's worried about being accepted. And you and Anthony, the chef, talked to Tammy about how she felt when her son came out to her.
One of the things for me, you know, that I struggle with when Miles came out to me that he was gay, I think it felt like almost a broken dream of him having a child.
I totally get that.
Do you mean that for Miles or for you?
For me, you know, that dream of him having, you know, a natural child that's his, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Miles can still have kids. I'm working on my kids next year, and they're going to be my children. Yes, we're going to have a surrogate, but they're going to be my babies. Just because he's gay doesn't mean he won't have his own children.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So, Tan, so we hear about your personal life as well.
Yes.
And there you are in Salt Lake with a Mormon husband. You've talked about how, in fact, interestingly, you being Muslim, him being Mormon, you have a lot in common, not drinking, not smoking. Mm-hmm. But we understand people walk up to you. Salt Lake is a progressive area within a very conservative state. But still, it's interesting that people walk up to you and talk about the effect on their lives of the show.
Yes. I had a 52-year-old man come up to me at a store. He was staring for a couple of minutes and said, I just wanted to tell you that you've changed my life. He said, I watched the episode where AJ comes out, and it empowered me to go and see my mom, and I came out to her. He said, I've been married for over 30 years. I've got children, and I've lied for decades now, and I didn't want to lie anymore, and I just wanted to feel the happiness that I see you guys feel on the show. And so, yeah, it felt really emotional and massively impactful. It's not just a coastal show. The fact that people are watching in places like Utah and are hugely affected by this is it feels so special. It's really not just for liberal Americans. This is global.
Well, and yet, we just reported recently on four young men chased from a gay pride festival there in Salt Lake by an angry mob yelling slurs. Another young gay man held the mob off. It was pretty chilling.
Yeah, it saddens me deeply that this continues to happen, but it's a reminder that visibility is the only way that we're going to hopefully quash this in the end, that we are accepted into society as the norm.
The Fab Five.
The Fab Five.
It's like superheroes. That's Tan France, one of the Fab Five on the Netflix show Queer Eye. The second season of the show is out tomorrow. Tan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Robin.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Soccer's 2018 World Cup begins today in Russia and will run through mid-July. In 2014, Brazil hosted, Germany won. This year, 32 teams from around the world will compete, 736 players, 64 games played at 12 stadiums. The U.S. didn't qualify, but yesterday was awarded the 2026 Games to share with Canada and Mexico, so that's something. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, I love this morning on the BBC, a Russian was saying, you know, we don't even really like soccer. Russia isn't a favorite to take it all. But which teams are the favorites this year?
Yeah, that's one of those, it seems a little like motivated reasoning, or, oh, we don't really like, by the way, we're not predicted to win. And the only reason we're in the cup is because the host always gets a team in the cup.
Right.
By the way, that's an open question. Will the United States automatically qualify because they're sharing with Mexico and Canada?
Yeah.
The team that's there's no odds on favorite this year. There's no team that's dominant, but sort of the usual suspects of soccer greatness and recent soccer greatness would be considered the favorites: Germany, Spain, Brazil. Mm-hmm. Germany won the last one. Spain recently replaced their manager. And by recently, I mean 2 days ago, he took a job with the club team, Real Madrid. National Federation didn't like that. So their coach is out.
I know.
I don't know how that'll affect things.
Everything's in an uproar.
And here's the thing with Brazil. They've won the most World Cups, but they have won all of their World Cups except one in their hemisphere or in the Americas. So going to Europe, they did it in 1958 in Sweden. Can they do it again? Perhaps they can. As you mentioned, you know, in Brazil, Germany won. So you can cross an ocean and win a World Cup.
Right. I love the global nature of this. Egypt has this player, Mohamed Salah, who played for Liverpool, where fans there created this chant, if he's good enough for you, he's good enough for me. If he scores another few, then I'll be Muslim too. I mean, it has a way of, you know, bringing people together. Half the world will be watching this.
I guess. Is that chant really on the cutting edge of wokeness? I don't know. They love Salah.
For Liverpool,
Salah
I think.
Yeah. Salah's one of these guys. So Egypt has one of the 10 best players in the world and then 10 of the, I don't know, some other player. But they have a chance because they're in this rather weak group, actually. And so getting out of group play, there are the powerhouses. But just with one or two wins or a couple of ties, you can see upsets in the especially first round of the World Cup.
We have to mention it could be the last World Cup for some of the giants. Argentina's Messi, Portugal's Ronaldo.
Yeah, Ronaldo, what a great player for Portugal. And Portugal plays Spain in their first game. That's one of the most anticipated games of the tournament. Lionel Messi, perhaps the greatest scorer in international soccer history. These guys are aged, but I know that they have something in their feet. They have something left.
And who else should we look for? Poland's Lewandowski, maybe? I mean, who are some of the other names to look for?
Well, I'll give you a country. Peru, if you want a country who really can do some damage. You don't think of the Peruvians, but they got their star player back, Guerrero, from what could have been a suspension. And Peru's a plausible country to make some noise. But how can you not root for Iceland? This is a country that became the smallest country ever to qualify for the World Cup. They did well in the European tournament. They scored almost all their goals on the same play, a throw-in. Maybe other teams are scouting that play.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right,
but
Iceland.
The Vikings could win.
Iceland it is. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst and editor of the new book, Upon Further Review. Thank you, Mike. Go now to Colorado, where wildfires are burning across large parts of that state. Officials say the huge 416 fire in southwestern Colorado has spread to 27,000 acres because of drought conditions there. And there's an air quality alert because of the heavy smoke conditions. Reporter Dan Boyce is right in the middle of it in Durango. Dan, not just the flames, but the smoke. How bad is it in Durango?
My eyes are burning as we speak, Robin. Mm-hmm. It's much worse in the mornings around here. The smoke sinks and spreads in the cooler air of the nighttime. It does lift a bit in the afternoon, but very smoky. It's devastating not only for those directly affected by the blaze here, but the economic engine of this entire community. I was speaking with local wedding photographer Alexi Hubble, and she's telling me that when this fire first started, businesses were quickly trying to spread the word, hey, Durango's still open, tourists, never fear kind of thing. The fire's burning well over 40 square miles, so that's getting a lot harder.
Well, we have some sound from her. Let's listen.
Now that everybody is dealing with the smoke, and now that our trail systems are shut down within town, not just the National Forest, our lakes are shut down, nobody can do any type of outdoor activity, which is what Durango is known for.
So the air quality in Durango there at hazardous levels, that's the poorest level on the air quality index. Dan Boyce, we also know that San Juan National Forest Purgatory Resort, the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad, all closed. So this is having a big impact.
Yeah, just to take the Narrow Gauge Railroad, it's a big tourist attraction. That alone, as an example, if that is closed for the month of June, which it already looks like it's going to be, that one attraction alone, it's estimated that will bring about a $33 million economic impact mm-hmm. to the community.
Wow. Well, people have been evacuated. Have homes been lost?
No, it's actually pretty remarkable. The fire conditions here, the topography and everything is extremely challenging, but it's actually, so far, it's quite a miracle. No structures, no lives have been lost in the blaze.
I hope that continues. Some storms are on their way. People will be thankful for some rain, but storms can also bring lightning.
So looking at weather here, just in the very short term, I was at a press conference yesterday. The fire's incident commander, Todd Pechota, he was asked if upcoming weather was set to provide any relief to crews on the fire, and he looked at that reporter, and he just flatly said, no. Mm-hmm. There are some cooler temperatures expected this weekend, which could bring some precipitation. You know, who knows, lightning, like you say. But Pechota said, as far as precipitation, he'd believe it when he sees it. In the longer term here, the conditions are absolutely terrible. Winter snowpack was just nothing. It's really a perfect storm for wildfires. If you look at the information the U.S. Forest Service is putting out, they don't estimate getting this fire, the 416 fire, contained till the end of July.
Oh, boy. Dan Boyce there in Durango, Colorado, taking note of the wildfires there. Dan, be safe and thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
An initiative to split California into three states has gathered enough signatures to qualify for the November ballot. The Cal3 plan seeks to create a Northern California, a Southern California, and then a third piece would simply be California. Joining us now is Scott Schaefer, senior politics and government editor at KQED in San Francisco and co-host of Political Breakdown. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
So first of all, just give us an idea of how the state would be split under this proposal.
Yeah, so it would be split into three parts, obviously. The first part would be called Northern California, and it would include San Francisco, Sacramento, and everything up to the Oregon border. Southern California would be the middle part of the state, Fresno, Bakersfield, all the agricultural parts of the state, Disneyland and San Diego. Mm-hmm. And then the state that would just be called California would be Los Angeles and all the counties along the coast going up to Monterey.
And the person behind this is billionaire venture capitalist Tim Draper, who previously wanted to split California into six states in 2016. That didn't work out. What's his angle now?
You know, I guess less is more. He thinks maybe it's it'll be somehow cheaper or easier. You know, it's the same idea. He thinks that the state is too big, that in terms of infrastructure and taxes and education, that all these services that a state government now delivers would be easier done by smaller entities that are closer to the people, so to speak. He's done this a few times. He's got a lot of money and I guess a lot of time on his hands, too, because he's been thinking about this several years now, and it will finally be on the ballot in November.
Is there any proof of what he says about the fact that it would be easier to deal with things like education and infrastructure if you split the state into three?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, it would create a lot of complications. First of all, just think of every kind of service or interaction you have with your state government, DMV, voter registration. You get in-state tuition. Let's say if you live in Fresno and you go to school at UCLA, well, all those things could go away. You mm-hmm. might have to, you know, re-register. And, you know, it just all kinds of questions. Water, abortion rights, immigration, sanctuary state. I mean, everything that the state now does would be suddenly up to these three new entities that would be created. And, you know, of course, there are many, many legal hurdles before it would even get to that point.
Right. And some people that have been talking about this, not necessarily this proposal, but the idea of making California into more than one state, would say it's going to have more power in Washington, at least in the Senate, because right now, even though it's got a huge population, it's only got two senators, just like all the other states. But if it were split into three, there would be six senators.
Exactly. And you can see right away that probably looking at the politics of the way this is divvied up, you'd end up with two more Democratic senators potentially and at least one, maybe two Republican senators. So it's a real roll of the dice if you're a politician. I mean, in terms of the Electoral College and presidential politics, California is now pretty reliably blue. Mm-hmm. If you split it up into three, that would change that calculation. And not to mention the legislators who are now in Sacramento, you know, they would basically be out of a job and have to, you know, run presumably for office in their new state. So it's very, very complicated and the longest of long shots, I'd have to say.
What do voters think of it so far?
We haven't really seen any polling. I mean, in the past, there's been a lot of skepticism about this when it's been floated, but it's never hasn't been on the ballot. It was kicked around in Sacramento a few decades ago, and it never really got very far. My guess is that people would be very skeptical because, you know, let's say just take that, you know, what would become Southern California. You would no longer be part of the part of the state that is the entertainment industry or Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. I mean, what happens to your revenue, for example? I mean, what happens? You become sort of one of the poorest parts of the entire United States without a real good source of revenue. That's, you know, just one thing to consider.
Now, this would have to go through Congress as well. If the voters do approve it, Congress would have to say yes as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for the reasons we talked about, the impact on power that these three new states would now have would be a real, you know, stumbling block. The impact on presidential politics and just, you know, the idea of breaking up a state. I mean, it hasn't happened since 1863 when West Virginia broke away from Virginia. But that was a whole different circumstance because it was during the Civil War and they had already Virginia had already seceded from the country.
One more thing while we have you. You're joining us from San Francisco, which has elected a new mayor, London Breed, who is the first African-American woman to ever serve in that role. What's been the reaction?
Well, it's been a long time coming in terms of counting the votes. The election was about 9 days ago. And, you know, she is 43 years old. She was born in San Francisco, raised in public housing about four blocks from City Hall by her grandmother. She's a real success story. And I think a lot of people, not just in the African-American community, but many others were inspired by her story and by her biography. She's going to be inheriting a lot of problems, as any mayor does in a big city, homelessness and the lack of affordable housing, just to name two. But, you know, it's going to be a new era. And, you know, it all happened because of the death of Mayor Ed Lee back in December.
Right.
And I think people will, you know, be giving her the benefit of the doubt and probably at least for the short term, some goodwill on her behalf.
That's Scott Schaefer, who is senior politics and government editor at KQED in San Francisco, also co-host of Political Breakdown. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we're heading into summer when there are all sorts of delicious fruits available. But wouldn't they be better in cake? Yes, cake. And if you don't want to bake, or you don't want to bake much, but you want a delicious dessert, here now resident chef Kathy Gunst has some ideas for you. Kathy, I always think that fruit can be made better by cake.
Absolutely. And cake can be made better by fruit.
Right. We have a couple of examples. So you're right, though, that you don't feel like heating up the whole kitchen with baking.
Yeah, so. I mean, on a humid summer day, it's the last thing you want to do. But there are many ways to get around this. I've made three different cakes for
you. Yes,
you have. One is a traditional baked cake in the oven. One is a refrigerator cake, and one is an ice cream cake.
Oh,
and for fear of melting, let's start with the ice cream cake.
Is that this one here?
That is that one.
It looks like a big Oreo.
This is the most refreshing, simple, and might I say fun cake to make, because what you do is you mix and match. You want to start with at least two flavors of ice cream. Mm. I made this in a bowl, and I took a metal bowl, and I lined it with parchment paper, and then I put vanilla ice cream in on the bottom.
It looks like you put a little something under
I
it.
I did. I crushed chocolate cookies. Oh. I threw them in the food processor until they were very fine. I lined the bottom. Then I did the vanilla. Then I melted some really good semi-sweet chocolate, and I laid that on top of the ice cream. Mm-hmm. Once that's set, I put my next flavor of ice cream. In this case, it is a butter pecan, and then more chocolate crumbs and more chocolate. Mm-hmm. Now, think of the possibilities. What about ginger snaps with ginger ice cream and raspberry sorbet, or lemon sorbet with the chocolate and crushed lemon cookies?
How about moose tracks with...
And there you go. Okay, I got you on the track here.
Oh, man.
Any cookie you love, any ice cream you love, the chocolate, although it sounds like it's not a chocolate sauce, I literally melted very good quality chocolate, and it hardens, and it tastes like the outside of those very expensive ice cream bars.
Yeah, and then do you, before you eat it, do you have to freeze it? Is that...
You freeze it between each layer.
Between each
layer. It only takes time because of the freezing.
Yeah.
And then you unmold it by putting a warm towel around the edge of it and pop it out, and you get this gorgeous layered cake. Now, you could surround that with raspberries and blackberries, and it would be quite stunning.
And it would make you feel as if you were doing something healthy.
Something healthy. Yeah, you can have a thin sliver of this.
Wow, it's gorgeous. Okay, now we have another one that it also looks like an ice cream cake.
It's not. That is a trip back to childhood. This is a chocolate strawberry whipped cream refrigerator roll. Did you grow up with these where you layer chocolate cookies with whipped cream?
Yes.
And you put it, that's what that is. Mm. But I upped the game a little bit by adding some fresh sliced ripe seasonal strawberries. And then I grated some of the cookies on top. And that's what that chocolate dusting is. You literally whip some cream, layer some chocolate cookies you buy at any supermarket, and put a slice of strawberry in between, whipped cream on top, and the next day, your cake is ready. It's or like that
a,
night.
It's like a log.
I do want to mention my mother-in-law, Nancy Rudolph, made that for her children, and then my children, every time they went to see Granny, Granny, please make the refrigerator cake.
Yeah.
And she did every time. So, so that's in honor of her.
And you think of
course.
Her, too. All right, we come here to, this is
our traditional cake. This I baked in an oven. And I just want to point out that when it's hot, I always bake first thing in the morning or late at night.
Okay.
Because the sun is not burning. Your kitchen's not quite that hot yet. I like to do it in the morning because I wake up with a lot of energy. This is
what, you?
Me? Okay. Moi? This is a sour cream lemon bundt cake. And this came from our very own producer, Karen Miller Medzen. Karen learned this recipe when she went to the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts.
We have to brag on her a little bit.
Totally.
Karen Miller,
she's turned into a major
baker.
She's
amazing. Every year she wins the Public Radio Bake Off.
This is
and
right.
We'll show you some of her cakes. And we'll put some of the pictures at herenow.org.
Well, she was bragging to me, oh, Kathy, you have to try my citrus cake. And I'm like, send me the recipe. I got this beautiful cast iron bundt tin. I'm going to try it. I added only lemon, Meyer lemon, fresh lemon, lemon zest. Mm. And I called Karen and said, I've made this cake 10 times. And every time I make it, it's better than the time before.
And you know, pretty soon, Kathy Guntz, you're going to get it right.
Yeah, right.
This is amazing. You can taste. I mean,
it's such a good summer cake because it's refreshing, right?
But even though it's got, what did you say, sour cream?
I used Greek yogurt, actually, a little bit lighter and a lot of lemon zest. Karen makes it with orange and lemon. I like the purity of the lemon flavor. This is a cake. Once you make it, you can do the whole thing in about 20 minutes and pop it in the oven and walk away. And again, do it when the sun's not at its peak. And this cake will keep for several days. This would be so beautiful with some mashed rhubarb simmered up in water, some sliced strawberries, fresh berries, because it's a very quote-unquote plain cake, but it's the best type of cake because it's not too sweet, unlike our ice cream cake.
Which, oh my God, you know, it is going to melt, so probably we should stop
think,
now.
I think it's part of your job not to let that melt.
Exactly. That would be so bad. Kathy Guntz, Summer Cakes. We'll have all of the recipes at herenow.org. Kathy, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And we'll also have pictures, Jeremy, of Karen's cakes. My favorite is you and me in marzipan.
You know, when we had Dollister Miles, the pastry chef from Alabama, on, I said on the air that Karen would make that cake, and she did. And she has not forgotten that I make promises like that on the air that I then get to enjoy.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.